Thanks, Bruce. This has been a long time coming, and I appreciate all of you that came today. I'm curious, if you've been to a Grateful Dead concert, raise your hand. Look at that. That's got to be a quarter of the people in the room. If you have Grateful Dead music in your house or on your phone, raise your hand. Okay, a little more, but not much. So last week, or the past couple of weeks, I've been asking people about the Grateful Dead, and many people in our congregation said who. So we're going to have a little lesson on the Grateful Dead, and then there are a few key points that I'm going to make about the dead and what they did. So here we go. Last July was a great month. I went to the Northwest String Summit, in North Plains, Oregon, at the infamous Hornig's Hideout, where modern bluegrass jam bands played for 4 days on four different stages, and everybody camped and had a great time. 5,000 people. I camped there with my son, Luke Brody, and his family, Kelsey, and my grandsons, Arlo and Teddy. So we were all there together having a great old time with these jam bands, bluegrass. Come Sunday morning, we get up and we go down to the, you know, the bowl where the show is. And the MC, we call him Reverend Tim, he happens to be from Butte, announced that the morning service would be Grateful Gospel. This is performed by Keller Williams, who'll be here in October if you want to see him at the Eagle Ballroom. And the band played what Reverend Tim said was the gospel according to Jerome Garcia. It was sold out. It was joyously received. Hallelujah. It was phenomenal. And if you're interested, you can see that whole set on YouTube if you just Google Grateful Gospel and String Summit. So I'm a deadhead, all right? And so are a lot of people, young and old, that I know. We're everywhere. And although the Grateful Gospel was a fun caricature of the dead for a Sunday morning with your family, there's truth in the idea that the Grateful Dead had elements of spiritual experience for many, many people. So I first listened to the Grateful Dead as a freshman in college. I got there and somebody had an album, and it was the one with the ripple bottle on the front. It's right here up front. There's a whole bunch of artifacts from my life here that relate to the Grateful Dead. And you're welcome to come up, and even if you want to borrow something, I'd be open to that. So I went to my first show in 71, February of 71. And honestly, I left a changed person. I really had no idea. And my enthusiasm continues to this day. So a few words about the band, okay? There were five original members: Phil Lesh, bass; Bill Krutzman, drums; Bob Weir, rhythm guitar, vocals; Rod Pigpen McKiernan, who was the keyboard player; and Jerry Garcia on lead vocal and guitar. But the band was bigger than that, and their writers were very influential on them. In fact, the Dead didn't write many lyrics themselves. They were written by their writers, which is interesting. So their songwriters were Robert Hunter and John Barlow. And not surprisingly, the Grateful Dead's primary lyricists were very spiritual and religious people. They were artists deeply inspired by mystery and tragedy. Robert Hunter wrote lyrics for Jerry, and the other lyricist, Barlow, wrote them primarily for Weir. By the way, John Barlow, He was a religious studies major as an undergraduate at Wesleyan University. So there is a future for religious studies majors. The keyboardist and the dead, they refer to the seat at the piano as the hot seat. The three, they had a number of keyboardists. Pigpen was the first, Keith Godchow in the 70s, Brent Midland in the 80s, and Bruce Hornsby after that. Three of those keyboardists died while they were in the band. Okay, so that's why they call it the hot seat. There was one woman who was a member of the Grateful Dead for a very long time, Donna Jean Godchow. She was the wife of Keith. And the audience is an integral part of the band itself. And in fact, there was a belief that the band and the audience played together. I want to mention Bill Graham, who is a rock promoter, and he operated the Fillmore East and Fillmore West. And I can tell you, where Bruce comes from, the West Coast, I come from the East Coast, and Fillmore East was a place that I went to quite a bit when I was young. And Bill Graham introduced the bands, and he once introduced the Dead as, they're not the best at what they do. They're the only ones that do what they do. Bruce mentioned the psychedelic era of the Dead. The Dead went through four decades. In the 60s, it was quite psychedelic, and that arose out of the acid test. LSD was legal. There were a couple of crazy people around, like Neil Cassidy and Ken Kesey, who you might know. And these acid tests were places where people were invited, and they took drugs, and the band took drugs, and everybody played together. I think it formed an intimate relationship between the band and its audience straight off, right from the beginning. The 70s was I think, the greatest decade of the Dead. They came out, they changed their approach from psychedelic to Americana, and they produced Working Man's Dead and American Beauty. And that was incredible that they could switch from such far out things to singing songs about the devil, coal mines, playing cards, things that Americans do. They toured Europe as one of the largest groups of people, I think, imaginable. They took a hiatus in the 70s and took 2 years off because they didn't think they were going anywhere. Around this time, Laura and I were getting ready to get married, and I said, Laura, you know, in order to get married, you're going to have to see the Dead live. About a week before we got married, we went down to the Boston Music Hall, it was called then, and saw the Dead, and just kept that up. Interestingly, during that time, the Grateful Dead played at the Great Pyramids. And that was just something they wanted to do. And they went over there and they set up the stage and brought in all the local people, and they played several days right below the Great Pyramids. I think that was a great decade. The 80s, they had top 10 hits. They became popular. I remember teaching high school and my students knew the songs. That was pretty cool. But unfortunately, drugs became, although drugs had been present the entire time, they really became overbearing. And Jerry, at one point, went into a diabetic coma. He recovered and had to learn guitar all over again. The 90s were big stadiums, fans were knocking fences down, drugs were crazy, and Jerry died following a show in Chicago. The last show of the summer tour in 95, he went back to California and he died alone So over those you know, decades and 30 years, the dead evolved quite a bit. So back to the script. Grateful Dead concerts have been described as a place of worship. The band was the high priest, the audience, the congregation, the songs, the liturgy, and the dancing, the prayer. And dancing was a big deal. In fact, out in the foyer of the theaters, they would put speakers. So you couldn't see the band, but you could hear them. And people would just dance. And it was freedom at its best. The Dead embody not only the cultic tendencies in rock and roll, you know, like those rock and rollers and cults that they have, but below the surface of the Dead, there really was a religious and spiritual underpinning. Their live concerts bear uncanny resemblance to religious festivals, like the one at String Summit. I mean, it was crazy. So, with interviews with the Dead, the members admitted that they looked upon their music as something like religion. Phil said, "We used to say that every place we played was church." And I kind of felt that way. And Garcia added that on a certain level, it was religion to him too. So I want to say a few words about Jerry Garcia. And I wanted to have Jerry with me. Okay, Jerry, we're together on this. Oh, please. All right. So when Jerry was 6 years old, he stood on the bank of a river outside of San Francisco, and he watched helplessly as his father drowned offshore, 6 years old. And such a tragedy undoubtedly changes a person. Jerry's understanding of God and his own place in the universe was certainly transformed that day. And we can't know if that was the most important factor in his psychological or religious development. By the way, he was raised Catholic. But we see some correlations in the music later. So when he sings about transience, about the necessity of finding joy in the moment, we can imagine that we understand that that's where he came from. When we hear his compassion for the characters in songs like Black Peter, or when we ourselves feel sympathy for them, when we're listening to the songs and feeling the sadness of the characters, the lovers, the warriors, the addicts, the murderers, the devil, and friends of the devil. We see that he was able to move through his own pain to find a deeper compassion for human beings. His example inspires us to deepen our compassion for others on our path. And as you might guess, Jerry sings more about transience and about the cycles of life than he does about permanence or eternity. So that song, Eyes of the World, in the prelude this morning, we heard the words, "There comes a Redeemer, and he slowly too fades away. There follows a wagon with him that's loaded with clay. And the streets that were silent all burst into bloom and decay. And the night comes so quiet, it's close on the heels of the day." These lyrics speak of the impermanence of life, the cycle of birth and death, of which we are all part. It doesn't feel tragic, but it's natural. We all bloom in our time. We all die and decay, and that's the way it works. Combined with the image in the first verse of winter, summer, home, it provides the hope that the cycle will continue. And in the next verse, we're reminded that the transient nature of life often means that we must be self-reliant. Sometimes we live no particular way but our own. Sometimes we visit your country and we live in your home. Sometimes we ride on your horses and sometimes we walk alone. Sometimes the songs that we sing are just songs of our own. There's loneliness, melancholy, but also a certain defiance, a determination to live as best as possible according to the beat of the drummer that we hear. This is the independent spirit so celebrated in the United States and is foundational to the Grateful Dead experience. I like to think of them as America's band. But even in our independence, even amidst the cyclic seasons of our world, the refrain shows that we're all connected, all part of a unified whole, all in the life of the spirit. Wake up, find out, you are the eyes of the world. The whole world is looking through your eyes. What a wonderful concept. Whatever you do, you're part of a grand and glorious cosmos. And it reminds me of another belief that through us, the universe has evolved a conscience. You may be familiar with that philosophy. The universe has the power to dream a better future on its own. We are the eyes and the hands and the conscience of the world. This is genuinely hopeful. And in another line, wake now, discover that you are the song that the morning brings. Just as the night comes on the heels of the day, so does the dawn come again, and we are the song that the new morning is singing. You know, Jeremiah lost his father, big father, but he found a place for himself in the living, evolving world, as crazy it was back then. He discovered a oneness with all creation, and he sang about it to whomever would listen. And there were a lot of us listening. Okay, now a few words about fans, because, the Deadheads. These are, as I said, these are part of the band. The Dead's massive popularity puzzles many casual observers. To some, the Dead are tie-dye troubadours of freewheeling drug use. Even if only two of their nearly 200 songs mention drugs. Others see lingering paragons of long-gone counterculture. But the Dead were firmly apolitical. Think about the 60s, they're firmly apolitical, distancing themselves from contemporaries who sang of new and the external American dream of passivism, collectivism, free love. The Dead were not about that. They were about the music. And although in true Dead style, they did not judge even each other, Dead songs are markedly different. They explore an ancient but internal dream. And Jerry said, for me, the lame part of the 60s was the political part, the social part. The real part was the spiritual part, which helps explain the band's peculiarly enduring legacy. It was the spiritual part. The Dead formed a lasting spiritual connection with its fans by adapting to the contemporary audiences, the very typical biblical story of exile, promise, and return home. Plucking these themes from traditional American music, and they covered a lot of American songs, they spoke to deeply held aspirations and worries. Even the shape and direction of their storied live performances traced this story musically from the familiar to wilderness or wildness, and then to paradise. And there was a rhythm to that song of the familiar, and then going into the unfamiliar, and then returning. The ancient stories saturate their lyrics. While their songs tell of misfits and outsiders and loners and drifters and devils and friends of the devil, the music is often lilting and transcendent, sweet. In the song Wharf Rat, for example, this is classic, a down and out homeless person sings with surprising brightness, I know that my life, that the life I'm leading is no good. I'll get a new start. I'll get up and fly away. I'll fly away. Doubt and yearning for a promised land are constant themes. Even in the end, Jerry sang, so many roads, all I want is one to take me home. So there's a writer, Dietrich Hirsch, who wrote Examining Grateful Dead Improvisation as a Catalyst for Creating Sustained Communities. Got that? Grateful Dead Improvisation for a Catalyst of Creating Community, argues that the Dead concerts facilitated transformative experience between participants by enabling them to step outside of their structural roles. That is, rather than being defined by the differences of class, gender, ethnicity, sexual orientation, etc. Within the community of the Grateful Dead and the concert experience, the individual experiences of the attendees, like Bruce or I, transgress these normally stable categories. Physically, more often than not, a Dead show did not have any seats. Everybody was milling around, and it was a rather open arena style where you could move as you see fit and dance as you like. The Dead live performance, as we said, mimicked the biblical story from Eden to exile to New Jerusalem. For example, a frequent show opener is Chuck Berry's The Promised Land, and it's about a troubled cross-country journey ending in glory, heading out from the East Coast to California and the sun and the glory of California. Chuck Berry. As shows progressed, however, the songs lengthened and bled together, sometimes melding into seamless layers of sound, hardly anything that sounded like a song. The Dead's improvisational flights could be melodious and beautiful, rhythmic, but were often astonishing, atonal assaults on orderliness and familiarity. Towards the show end, in healing musical transitions, the order is restored. The audience would be lyrically and sonically reoriented towards themselves and towards home. This phenomenon made Dead shows utterly unique. And I saw a lot of rock and roll shows when I was in New York, and there was nothing, and this is common phrase, right? There's nothing like a Grateful Dead show. For me, these dissonant jams that they would get into in the middle of Madison Square Garden were sometimes uncomfortable and would even cause panic attacks. Like, what's going on? And then the music would bring you back. You would return to the familiar, the verses either of the beginning song or of a new song entirely, and then everybody would be back with the band. It was a welcome relief of calmness and familiarity. The experience of reorientation that I'm talking about here is all the more sweet because doubt and peril precede it. This is what Garcia said about this dynamic. He said, tension is a part of what makes music work. Tension and release. Or if you prefer, dissonance and resonance, or suspension and completion. It's no wonder variations of the phrase, "I don't know," appear more than any other lyric in the Grateful Dead repertoire. I don't know. I think we've heard this before in New York stuff. I don't know. We'll see. Dissonance and obstacles complicate all our lives. Dead fans aren't special in this regard, but in the Dead's music, they found stories illuminating the eternal quality of these anxieties. The songs embody this type of existence. The sustained promise, however uncertain, of resolution and homecoming. The promise that you would always come home. By appropriating biblical metaphors of disorientation and reorientation, both in lyric, the song, and the live instrumental performances, the Dead gave voice to the yearning in its vast audience to shake off the anonymity, to be loved for themselves alone. One way or another, This darkness has got to give. Darkness always gives way to light. And so the Grateful Dead promised its fans, calling the band itself Jehovah's favorite choir. The band embraced its audience with a bit of wisdom that became one of its most loved lyrics. This is one of my favorites. Once in a while, you get shown the light in the strangest of places if you look at it right. For scholars of religion, the Grateful Dead experience looks like religion from the outside, as it contains with it all the traditional markers of religion, ritual, pilgrimage, belief, community, mythology, scripture, relics, iconography, miracles, and liturgy. And for the millions of deadheads, the Grateful Dead feels like religious experience. It does the work of the sacred in their lives by embodying the core experiential aspects of religion, such as consciousness, mysticism, creativity, meaning, purpose, identity, transcendence, and prophecy. The association of spiritual and transcendental qualities with the band and their music is another key theme of Writers About the Dead. David Bryans writes in The Grateful Dead Religious Experience, he comes at the dead through language commonly used to describe more traditional religious and spiritual activities, again, from the outside. He contends that using language to describe the dead phenomena as a communal experience contributes a new dimension to our understanding of religious experience. And he cites a passage from Garcia, An American Life, to show how the music would take over the musician. So this has to do with the transcendence of the music. The music would take over the band. Meaning that as a group, they were operating beyond cognition and intention. So the band wasn't just playing the song, the words, and the notes. It was beyond the mechanics of simply playing the song well, which sometimes they did, to near effortless state of grace, where their music was speaking through them rather than from them. As Brian goes on to say, this helps explain how deadheads have an understanding of the divine. I cherish my memories of the Grateful Dead concerts and will never forget the collective joy of the audience, which was personal and radiating through me, as I said, with lyrics like, once in a while you get shown the light in the strangest of places if you see it right. Above all else, attending Grateful Dead concerts made me acutely aware of growing up, and that a big part of the process was being able to make decisions that I wanted to make, even if they didn't necessarily square with the social, political, cultural, and religious norms that I faced when I walked out the door. I could carry that with me. In closing, many authors have referenced the Grateful Dead as religious or spiritual experience, using transcendence, biblical references, the lived experience of the band and the audience, the fans following the band in a communal journey as examples of foundational spiritual religious beliefs. Yet, there's a profound paradox at the heart of the band's appeal. We know that the Grateful Dead was much more than the music, though it was really just about the music. Keep on trucking. Now I'm going to play a little bit of a musical interlude from the Dead that they played at the first show I saw in 1971. And it goes back a long way.